the last of the thing.
The meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will come to order. It is March 1st, 2011. And today on our agenda, we have a presentation about yesterday's economic forecast. And we have joining us Commissioner Jim Showalter, and I see Tom Stinson, our state economist, and Margaret Kelly, our budget director, are also with him. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Management and Budget. Pleased to be here to present the February forecast that was released just yesterday. In the past, this has been, a pretty straightforward presentation with, a really useful opportunity for members to ask questions and answers. So I would just encourage that throughout the process. If you hit upon a slide or an area that you would like some more information on, we would be happy to do so. The complete document is also available on the website. I think it's very useful background. It reflects a lot of the thought and questions that the economists and the budget staff have put into this forecast, because it's really not a straightforward question of, well, you know, what's the economy going to do? You know, there's a lot of questions that go with that. Once you figured that out, you still have to figure out how that impacts our revenues or our spending. So I commend that to you for your review as well. Even before it was released, the figure was apparently out an hour or so before the press conference itself. So I don't think it's news to this committee, but the forecast improved by $1.2 billion. Budget gap has, as a result, shrunk from roughly $6.2 billion to $5 billion. This is a combination of a number of factors, most notably tied to congressional action since the November forecast. In that action, they confirmed some of the economic stimulus that people had already anticipated in the economic forecast, but went further than that, changing the payroll taxes so that there's some direct stimulus that will be felt by households, as well as the delay of the capital gains tax, which is anticipated to have a disproportionate impact on state revenues based on some behavioral assumptions. Dr. Stinson will get into that quite a bit in just a minute. Bottom line here is we've got some improvement here in the current year, that is fiscal 11, and that increase raises the overall revenue projection for 12 and 13 somewhat, leading us to the $1.2 billion of overall improvement. Combined with that, changes in spending also go in what we'd say the right way. A modest $176 million decrease in spending factors due to a number of more technical factors that Margaret Kelly will walk through in just a minute. Overall, we talked about this forecast, and I cannot say that I'm I can just completely say I'm pleased. The direction, this is certainly a very helpful bit of news for the state, and we think that it reflects some of the changes in anticipation of sort of the economy recovering. It's not there yet. There's still a lot of questions. There's still a lot of risk around this, but we're certainly pleased to see the direction of things right now. On the next slide, what you have here is just a breakdown of the revenues and expenditures for 2010 and 11 and 12 and 13. In the current biennium, net change in the bottom line is about $224 million, I believe. I'll check on my notes. And on the next biennium,
it's 97 at 896.
Okay.
Revenues.
260. Yeah. The bottom line for 2010 and 11 improves by $264 million. That balance carries forward into 12 and 13, as we discussed in some of the caucus briefings yesterday morning. The legislature suspended a permanent statute that would normally have put that balance into the reserves. That was necessary because the federal government basically has a blanket prohibition for using stimulus funds for building up rainy day funds or reserves, or even the appearance of that. And we didn't want to get anywhere close to suggesting that was going to happen. And so the executive branch and legislative branch just agreed to suspend that statute for the time being. As a result, the 663 rolls into the next biennium. shows up as part of the beginning balance you see in 12 and 13, and is used to decrease the overall deficit, which is at $5 billion once that's taken into account. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Tom Stinson. We'll talk about the economy, state revenues, and some of the major factors that are behind changes in this forecast.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langston.
Madam Chair, you know, when we're talking about the deficit and what we have to deal with, not, we were talking 6.2 and now we're talking 5. Nobody's suggesting we buy back the shift, this buy-in, this next buy-in. So what we're really talking about, what we have to deal with, is $3.6 billion, right?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator, for budget purposes, as you start budget planning and do targets and things like that, certainly the shift would be one of the first questions as to what you'd do. The forecast itself is a current law forecast, so we don't get to adjust the numbers for that, but for budgetary purposes, as you cross that line and make plans, yes, you'd start to take that decision or other decisions to get us to zero.
It does make it sound better.
Madam
Chair.
Senator Bono.
Madam Chair and Senator Langseth, it seems to be that that's what the governor did first thing. So.
The legislature will as well.
Thank you, Senator Langseth.
Mr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as the commissioner indicated, the revenues are better. Revenues in combined 2011, 2012, 2013 biennium are $984 million more than we forecast in November. $97 million or 0.6% more for fiscal 2010, and $887 million or 2.7% more than we forecast in November for fiscal 2012-2013. Those aren't huge percentage changes, but certainly they're welcome changes and they're in the right direction. Much of this improvement in revenues came about because of the December tax compromise that occurred in Washington, D.C. after the November forecast. Everybody was focused on whether the Bush tax cuts were going to be extended or not. Almost all forecasters had already incorporated that into their forecasts, that they believed that the Bush tax cuts would be extended. But there were a couple of less widely recognized changes that were made that had a big impact on the economic outlook for 2011. The most important of those was a two percentage point reduction in the payroll tax, which is starting to be observed by people in their own checks, their paychecks now. That was stimulus of $111 billion that wasn't expected. That, combined with a longer-than-expected extension of the 99 weeks extended unemployment insurance benefits and special provisions related to the expensing of capital equipment, allowed or produced an increase in forecasts of 0.8%, 0.9%, 1% from 2000 for 2011. Global Insights forecast in November for real growth in 2011 was 2.3%, which is not a particularly strong performance. You'd have to classify that as subpar. Their forecast now for real GDP growth is for 3.2%, 0.9% greater than was forecast in November, and that's gone over the line and is now considered to be pretty good growth in there. So that's what's happened. Now, if you look at this chart, you can see in the bars that most of that growth, the change in that growth, occurs in the first half of 2011. That's because these changes really are limited to 2011, and by the time we get to 2012, people's payroll taxes are going to go back up under current law by that 2%, and so there's not the same kind of stimulus available in there. For 2012, real GDP growth is forecast now to be at 2.9%, which is the same as was forecast in November. Well, that's the good news on the economy. The less good news on the economy is that Global Insight and most forecasters still expect very slow improvement in the workforce outlook. Labor force growth is still, or job growth is still not expected to reach its pre-recession levels until the middle of 2013, and in 2013, the unemployment rate is 7.8% still projected. What's the most interesting?
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Dr. Stinson, is that projection, is that a national figure, or is it is that a Minnesota figure?
Oh, that's
the unemployment.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the unemployment rate, the 7.8%, is a national number. Minnesota's unemployment rate presently is at 7%, and so that would mean that our unemployment rate got worse. Our forecast is for a modest improvement, but not a great improvement, and we would see unemployment dropping in somewhere the 6.5 to 6.8 area in Minnesota.
Okay,
typically, Minnesota's unemployment rate is 2% or 1.5% or 1%, somewhere in that range, depending on what's going on below the national rate. And we would expect that we would continue to be below the national rate, but not as far below the national rate as we are now.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Could I just, I should know the answer, and I've thought it but never asked. You mentioned the 2% cut of the payroll tax. Is the payroll tax the tax that funds Social Security, or is that a different tax?
Mr. Stinson.
Chair, Senator Olson. No, you're right. It is the tax. It's the FICA, the 6 3/8%.
Okay, that's what I thought. So that essentially creates a bigger hole in the Social Security issue that the feds have to deal with, right?
Exactly.
Mr. Stinson.
Thank you.
The most interesting part of this forecast really is related to another change that was made in the tax compromise bill. And in the tax compromise bill, the scheduled increase in capital gains tax rate from 15% to 20% was delayed for 2 years, and so it doesn't increase now until 2013. It produced an extraordinary amount of income for such a small part of the tax base. Capital gains realizations were about 3% of total Minnesota residential or total adjusted gross income for Minnesota residents, and that change in that small part of the tax base added 65% of the additional revenue.
Excuse me, Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stinson, have we ever looked at what would happen if our capital gains were taxed at a lower rate than ordinary income? Have we ever looked at whether or not we think that would generate significant income to the state based on people's behavior?
Mr. Stinson?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonner, we have looked at it not in a detailed fashion, but we have looked at it as part of some work we've done on the volatility of the tax system. And it reduces the volatility of the tax system enormously because this is, as you'll see in a second, a very volatile part of the of the tax system. But reducing the capital gains rate in Minnesota would reduce tax revenues. You would have to do something else to produce a revenue neutral change in the tax base. So you would have to raise the rate on other income or something like that in order to do it. So if you had something like a special partial exemption to capital gains, say, that might be good policy in terms of reducing the volatility of the system, but it would not raise more money.
But Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair and Dr. Stinson, but when we see what happens when you lower, when people have a sense of it being lowered because of what happened federally and then they took their capital gains here, isn't it possible that it might attract more people to want to invest in Minnesota if, in fact, it was treated differently so that, in fact, that would be offset with revenue?
Mr. Stinson?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, what happened with respect to the federal capital gains, the tax rate, was just pure gravy for states that tax capital gains the way Minnesota taxes capital gains. An expected rate change of 5 percentage points was eliminated, but we didn't have to bear any of the brunt of the lower rate. All that happened to us was we just got the benefit of the increased.
Thank you.
Mr. Stinson, since this is expected to blink off in January of 2013 or January 1st, how did that six-month into our biennium affect the forecast?
Madam Chair, the way that we do the forecast is that for items such as capital gains and other non-wage income, that is the change in the prior tax year. So tax year 2012, then that's counted in 2013 that shows up in 2013 revenues, fiscal 2013 revenues. So in fiscal 2013, we're still getting the good impacts of that. It's not until 14 and 15 that we get the blink off. And there are some potential problems with the blink off at the end of 2012, because in addition to the 5 percentage point increase in the capital gains rate that's scheduled, there's also, under the President's health care reform proposal, a scheduled 3.8% increase in the taxes on unearned income for people with more than $500,000. And so for those people, under current law, the tax rate on capital gains would go from 15% to 23.8%, which is a hefty increase. And we would expect that that would influence behavior and particularly revenues in our fiscal 14 and 15.
Is that one of the reasons that our tails are showing up as big as they are, because you've considered that?
We've considered that, but one of the problems that we have is that when you try to do a forecast, you're looking at history and what's happened historically when you have other large increases in capital gains or other large changes in whatever the variable that you're looking at is. And unfortunately, this is such a large increase that it's larger than anything we've seen in history. So your crystal ball becomes a little more cloudy.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stinson, what is Minnesota's capital gains rate?
Mr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, Minnesota doesn't have a capital gains rate.
Oh, it doesn't.
Capital gains is treated as regular income, and so whatever your income tax rate is, that is what capital gains is taxed at.
Okay, so that's why we are not affected. if we were to reduce our capital gains rate, we don't have one, so that doesn't do any good, right? But, well, but I was thinking of Senator Bonhoff's question that we benefited from the federal, but if we, you said if we did something to the Minnesota's capital gains rate, and you said we don't have a capital gains, so I'm trying now I'm a little bit confused.
Madam Chair, can I clarify, Senator Olson? Madam Chair, Senator Olson, people in Minnesota's capital gains are taxed at ordinary income rates, and so there's a disincentive, according to some, to do business here, particularly starting up new ventures where there's opportunities for high capital gains. And so what I've been told by those folks in venture capital and in those emerging fields is that Minnesota is not as attractive as a place to do those ventures because we don't allow capital gains to be taxed at a lower rate.
So Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, we would need to exempt it from the income tax rather than it having being a special capital gains rate. Or reduce that impact.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, yes, without wanting to put words in Senator Bonhoff's mouth, you could do something like, say, exempt 25% of capital gains or
from taxation
or something like that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Stinson, since that rate would be 23.5%, is that one of the reasons you're projecting so much activity in the next 2 years? Because people will foresee that coming, and they're going to be selling like crazy and to take advantage of the 15% rate before it goes up to the higher rate?
Madam Chair, no, that's not what's going on. What's going on is a recovery. I'm going to move to the next chart here. What's going on is a recovery from extraordinarily low capital gains realizations in 2009. In 2007, in Minnesota, this is U.S. capital gains on the graph, but I'll give you the numbers for Minnesota. In 2009, in Minnesota, capital gains were, or sorry, 2007, capital gains in Minnesota were $10.9 billion. We've had two consecutive years of a little bit more than 50% declines in capital gains realizations. And in 2009, our best estimate now coming from the sample is that we were at $2.5 billion. So we've fallen by more than 75% between 2007 and 2009. That's an unnatural level of capital gains realizations to expect. And so what you can see is the maroon bars here show what we had in the November forecast. The gold additions to those bars show how much more we added in the February forecast. And you can see that 2011 bar goes up quite a bit because of that's the change due to the change in the federal tax law. That has nothing to do with anticipation in there at all. And then the 2012 bar, again, doesn't have anything to do with anticipation at all. If people anticipate that change, we would have even more in the way of gains in 2012. But less in 2013 and in tax years 2013 and 2014 because those gains that were taken in 2012 would have been accelerated from gains that would have been taken otherwise in later years.
Okay, thank you.
We've discussed this capital gains quite a bit, and so I'm going to just
Senator Rangus.
Not to throw some more in here, but, you know, the other Tom was in talking to the tax committee and us in a joint hearing here recently, and Tom Gillespie, yeah. And, you know, his estimations are that, you know, in the future we'll have slower government revenue incomes as populations age and so on, and his trends go on. And then now this curve comes in here with the significant increase in capital gains taxes on the federal level affecting this. So are we just seeing a blip here? If we're going to sit down and look at trends for the next 4 or 5 years as we look at our spending, and if our spending growth continues on the way a lot of folks are projecting here, are the trains on a collision course, Dr. Stinson, or how are we going to prepare ourselves for the out years in the bienniums 14, 15, 16, 17, and so on?
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, there are two documents that I've helped to provide the data for that are important in your thinking about the longer term. And for Tom Gillespie and me, the longer term is not 14 and 15. It's not really even 16 or 17. It's looking on out to 2020 and beyond. There was a 10-year forecast that was released sometime January 15th or something like that. It's probably what Tom Gillespie was speaking to your committee about. 2 years ago, there was also a 25-year forecast that was done for the Long-Term Budget Trends Study Commission. And the results from both of them are surprisingly, given the economic forecast, similar. And the one that frames the picture, I guess, the best for me is the 25-year forecast. And this was done before the recession, the depth of the recession was known or anything like that. And the results are a mixture of good news and bad news. And the good news is that revenues will grow between now and 20, 25 years from now. But they're going to grow at about a 3.8% rate, which is slower than the growth that we were used to in the late 90s and early part of the 2000s. The good news is that if healthcare expenditures continue to grow at about an 8.5% rate, there is money left over for everything else, K-12 education, parks, corrections, and so on like that. The bad news is that the money that's left over is the same dollar amount, not adjusted for inflation, but the same dollar amount as 25 years earlier. Now, the 10-year forecast has a little starker results for it, and my impression of those results, I might be wrong on this, but I think this is what Tom Gillespie is saying, is that you can look at this another way and say, if you have normal growth in revenues, which is again about 3.9 or 4%, I think the growth rate in revenues is 4.1 in the 10-year forecast, and you have 8.5% growth in healthcare expenditures, and you have normal growth in education expenditures, there is no money left for everything else.
Yeah.
So I think that frames the longer term, not the 14 and 15, maybe not even the 16 and 17, but the 10-year outlook or the 25-year outlook pretty well.
And Mr. Stinson, do you think 8% is realistic with the aging population that we have for healthcare growth?
For 25 years, it might be, because there might be some kind of a breakthrough in treatment of Alzheimer's, for example, or something like that. I mean, that's a long time, and technological change could make a lot of difference in healthcare costs. But absent some technological change, I think the implications of your question are right, that that's probably an optimistic estimate.
Um,
is a slide showing where the revenues came from. $499 million of the 12 and 13 budget, 3.2% growth came from the individual income tax, and as we said, as I said earlier, 65% of that came from this change in capital gains realizations, and 35% came from other. The sales tax, $249 million in 12 and 13, a 2.8% increase in over November's forecast. Of that, about two-thirds came from higher gross receipts under the sales tax, payments by retailers to the state, and about a third of that came from an expected decline in sales tax refunds, primarily on capital equipment. So really only two-thirds of that is economically driven. Part of that is the other one-third of that is a change in the way that the sales tax refunds were calculated. Corporate tax and statewide property tax change only very slightly. The other revenues piece, $108 million, that's a little bit deceptive. And what's a little deceptive about it is that $59 million of that is due to the change in the expected receipt date of the reciprocity, the final reciprocity payment from Wisconsin. We've now moved that out of fiscal 2011 and into fiscal 2012. So part of the gain in other revenues in 2011 would have been higher had we not done that, and there would have been an offsetting decline in fiscal 2012-2013. 2.7% change in 2012-2013, which again is well within our normal margin of error in the forecast. Here's another way of looking at the changes, starting at the bottom. 39% of the total revenue change that we had was in capital gains, 17% in all other types of income on the individual income tax, 19% in gross sales tax, 9% in sales tax refunds, and then other reciprocity and corporate amounted to about 17%. The bottom line on this is that, and just stresses that we have a large portion of this forecast relying on a change in capital gains revenue. Part of the change in capital gains revenue is due to a change in the expected rate, but the stock market would have something to do with it, and if the stock market doesn't perform particularly well, we would expect that we might not do as well on this side as well. What we believe has happened is that the confidence interval around the forecast has widened. And in the last few years, we've had an implicit confidence interval, but it's almost always been asymmetric. It's always had a bigger downward potential than upward potential. People really didn't think that we would see the forecast outperforming what we'd seen by very much, and they could see all kinds of downside risk. This time, there are both downside risks and upside possibilities to the forecast. Let me show you some of the uncertainties that are in this forecast. The baseline forecast from Global Insight was prepared prior to much of the disruption in the Middle East, and that's certainly a major uncertainty. That's an uncertainty that has a downward potential for us. Higher oil prices would cause weaker economic growth, higher oil prices might well cause consumers to lose a little bit of confidence and pull back on their spending. So that's certainly something that we need to be concerned about. Federal budget action, there are really two actions here that are of concern. One is the continuing resolution and a potential federal budget shutdown. The impacts on Minnesota, the direct impacts on Minnesota of a short federal budget shutdown would be relatively small because we don't have a lot of federal employees in the state compared to states like Virginia and Maryland and New Mexico, for example. Still, the implications of a federal budget shutdown or federal government shutdown could be noticeable because it would affect consumer confidence or could affect consumer confidence. So that's a concern. Actually, the more serious concern is the increase in the federal deficit limit or federal debt limit in there. Were that not to happen, or even if it were not to appear to be a certainty, that would add uncertainty to investors thinking about the value of federal credits. It would drive interest rates up, and so people would pay more for interest for loans on houses, more for loans on cars, more for personal loans, more for business loans, and that would create a slight or potentially a large slowdown in the economy. So that's a concern. The employment growth area is another area of uncertainty, and here there's potential upside as well as potential downside. All the pieces are in place for stronger employment growth. What's really missing is the spark that sets it off, and if that were to occur, and were to occur relatively soon, we would see a stronger economy than is forecast here. Now, unfortunately, it might not occur, and so we could slog along and have subpar growth through much of the year as well. But there is certainly the opportunity and the potential for more economic growth and stronger growth on the employment side than is in this forecast.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Dr. Stinson, I'm wondering if there's any projection of what cuts in spending, state spending, will do to job growth. Like, for example, if you had a $1 billion cut, what kind of job effect, employment effect would you have and so forth? Is any of that included in your?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, in this forecast, because we do current law forecasting, because we don't know what the final resolution to the state's budget problem is, what we've done is we have held state employment, local employment constant, and we have held state and local wages constant. To the extent that state and local wages are reduced compared to what they were in 2010, or that employment is reduced compared to 2010, that would reduce the forecast for Minnesota. Our underlying assumption was that since we do a current law forecast, that the appropriate interpretation of current law is that nothing changes. So that's what we did.
Thank you.
Dr. Stinson, for the same kind of a takeoff on that, what if the federal budget cuts come down? What kind of an impact would that have if they're fairly significant?
Madam Chair, Minnesota is not a prime recipient of federal largesse.
So there's finally a time when it might benefit us.
So even though we pay more money to the federal government than most states, we get less than most states. And so this is one time where this works in our favor. Now, most of the time it doesn't work in our favor. But this would be one of the times where we would take a less severe hit than other states. That said, we could still take a significant hit because all programs aren't distributed equally across all the states. And to the extent that this was focused on agricultural program payments, for example, or something like that, we would take a more serious hit than a state like New York, for example.
Okay. When you were saying with employment growth that if there's a significant spark, what could be a spark that could drive employment growth? What would you speculate?
Well, I've already speculated and so far been proven wrong that the payroll tax impact, once people saw that extra $50 of pay period in their check, that they would go out and start spending it. I mean, $50 is enough money that it's noticeable. It's not a pizza a week like sometimes we've done. It's enough money that it's noticeable, but it's not so much money necessarily that you would say, oh, I've got to save this money, or I should use part of this money or something like that. And so it seemed to me like it was a nice sized amount, and that people would start their start spending, and once spending starts to go on, firms see that they need more employees to provide the services and produce the goods that are being demanded, and so they start hiring. Now, in the month of January, what turned out was that people didn't spend as much of this as I thought, and so far I've been proven wrong, but I've hoped that would be the key in there. Part of it just could be the fact that hours worked kind of have reached about a peak. And in order to get more output, you're not going to be able to work your existing workforce more. You're going to have to start adding employment. And to the extent that occurs, that would be something. There are a whole bunch of possibilities, and economists are might surprise you to know, not in unanimous agreement about what might go on here, but everybody has their own pet theory as to what's going to set off the employment growth, and of course, if we knew, we'd set it off. So.
Yeah.
Consumer spending is something that certainly could take off as consumers get a little bit more confident. Consumer confidence, consumer sentiment measures are still and recession levels. And again, if you think that one way of improving consumer, the outlook of the consumer is by giving them more money in their check, which would improve my outlook, then this payroll tax should work. We could have stronger housing growth than is in the forecast. The housing industry is just an amazingly difficult time, but once jobs increase, once household formation increases, the demand for housing increases, and so we can see that as well. On the revenue side, we've talked about capital gains.
Senator Magnus.
I got a question before you leave the economic side, Dr. Stinson, and that's about the monetary policy. And a lot of this is international, too. But in the United States, for example, this quantitative easing system now that the Federal Reserve has put in place, we've gone through QE1, and we're quite a ways through QE2, and there's some talk of doing a quantitative easing part 3 to spur inflation and, I guess, drive down the value of our dollar, which is upsetting the Chinese, for example, to no end because they own a lot of our debt. But could you give your thoughts on that type of a policy? How you see that shaking out? Do you see the odds of a QE3 coming in, and what effect do you really think this will have as we the Federal Reserve tries to spur inflation and drives down the value of the dollar.
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, let me just explain real quickly what the purpose of the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing was, and that is that if you have, typically the Federal Reserve works only on the shortest of the short interest rates, the federal funds rate. But the federal funds rate has been, as you know from looking at the interest you get on your checking account, for example, almost non-existent. And in order to provide stimulus, what they did was they moved out the yield curve and started trying to affect interest rates that had longer on longer maturity credits. This was a useful activity, in my opinion, a useful activity the first time they did it. The second time they've done it, which is now, has been less useful and in my assessment, has had no value at all in terms of stimulating the economy. I do not believe that they will do a QE3, and the reason, there are a couple of reasons, but I didn't talk about commodity prices and I didn't talk about inflation. The Federal Reserve's primary role is not to stimulate the economy. The Federal Reserve sees their primary role as keeping inflation under control. And to the extent that we have higher oil prices, higher grain prices, higher meat prices, higher metals prices, things like that, the Federal Reserve will take notice of that and begin to pull back on their stimulus for the economy. The easiest thing for them to do and the first thing that they would do would be not to do a QE3. And so I think that's what's likely to go on. Looking longer term, once we start seeing employment levels grow like 200,000 a month or something like that, I think you're going to see the Federal Reserve begin to start increasing the Fed funds rate. And the reason for that is that if economists think they know two things, the two things they think they know is that inflation comes from large injections of liquidity or increases in the money supply. And in order to keep the recession as limited as it was, which wasn't very limited, but in order to keep it from turning into a great recession, the Federal Reserve inserted a lot of liquidity into the system. They know that that has the potential for increasing inflation, and so they'll lean a little harder against the wind. And then the other thing that economists think that they know is that persistent large federal budget deficits also create enormous inflationary pressures. And so you've heard Chairman Bernanke already make statements to the fact that the federal government needs to get the budget deficit more under control. And so I think they will begin leaning against the wind because of that as well. And so I don't think that you would see any more easing, quantitative easing in this case.
Well, Madam Chair and Dr. Stinson, then the effect on interest rates and then in turn how that affects the housing markets.
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, the implications are pretty clear that we're going to have over the longer term, and here, you know, I'm talking 5, 6, 7 years, we're going to see higher interest rates than we would normally have seen. We're certainly going to see higher home mortgage interest rates than we're used to seeing in the last few years, but these have been extraordinarily low home mortgage interest rates. And so, you know, we're going to be seeing home mortgage interest rates in the sixes and sevens, but that's more normal. We're going to be back to a more normal situation in terms of home interest rates.
And so, Madam Chair, one more quick. What about the price of a house then? If the interest rates go up over the long term and you get so much money to pay it, what's that do to the price of your homes now that just... And we saw just recently, I saw some numbers that said the homes in the Twin Cities area, for example, went down 11% to, last year. And what do you anticipate will happen with that then if we do increase interest rates.
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, even if we don't increase interest rates, I think that for the next year or so, we're likely to see another decline in the value of housing. If interest rates increase, you're going to see a less rapid increase in the price of houses than you would have otherwise. But the real key to housing price increases gets back to jobs and household formation. If you don't see household formation, if household formation remains at these extraordinarily low rates, there's no demand for additional housing. And so that's what we need to have done.
Okay.
Senator Tom Gillespie may have told you one of the impacts of the change of the Great Recession on migration when he spoke to your group. But, you know, that's pretty striking that we've just saw a complete drying up of interstate migration and inter-county migration, for that matter.
So, Dr. Stinson, would it help if parents boosted out the adult children so that there could be more household formation?
You know, I just talk about theoretical stuff, not policy. Policy's up to you, Senator.
I was going to ask you, too, as far as you had earlier a slight gain in the statewide property tax, and I was wondering if that was based on just the value of the properties going up more, or if you're anticipating that there actually will be more business development.
Senator, or Madam Chair, we don't do that forecast. We get that from the Department of Revenue, the property tax people at the Department of Revenue. And we questioned whether that was actually going to happen or not. And they said, yeah, they thought it would, that their forecasts or their projections were that they would see a little bit stronger corporate, but commercial industrial property growth than we had. You know, I still wonder, given the lags in valuation, whether that's going to happen or not. But that under current law, that's supposed to remain constant. The rate's supposed to be adjusted to keep that constant, is my understanding. So you would see a slightly higher rate effect, I think, is what's going on, a property tax rate effect.
Thank you.
Well, you know, there's a lot of uncertainties. As always, there's reason to be cautious, but this time there are some reasons why we might be a little bit more optimistic as well. I'd be glad to continue to answer questions, but if there aren't any more questions, I can turn it over to the Budget Director, Margaret Kelly, to talk about the spending.
Thank you, Dr. Stinson.
Thank you, Chair, members
Ms.
of the
Kelly.
Committee. This forecast story is really about revenues. There's very little change on the expenditure side. $167 million reduced spending in the current biennium, and we're forecasting only $9 million of reduced spending in the next biennium. I'm just going to walk through them line by line. On K-12 education, we're continuing to anticipate enrollment growth, just not as much enrollment growth as we had forecasted in November. We're still forecasting about 4% enrollment growth, but in November, I think we were assuming around a 15,000 increase in students over the next biennium, and now we're down to about 13,300 in students, so it's about 850 or 950 fewer students being enrolled in fiscal year 12 and fiscal year 13.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kelly, what do you attribute that shift? Was it some different assumptions or mathematical calculations or what? That's kind of the cohorts are there. It's got to be something that's that would have driven that change or seemingly erroneous number in the November forecast. Can you give any insight on that?
Senator Scott? Olson, my understanding is it's primarily driven by birth rates, and so what we've seen in the past year has revised our forecast for growth going forward.
So, Madam Chair, Senator that takes Olson? A few years from birth before they get counted in a cohort for K-12 education, and that's not within even a four-year range of the budget. So what does that mean?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think we'd be going back about 5 years and seeing how the birth rates have translated into actual enrollments, and so it's movement of students in and out of the state, in and out of the district.
So, Madam Chair, that changed significantly between November and February in terms of how you would look at that?
Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, it changed enough to change the forecast. We're talking a couple hundred thousand students in the statewide.
Could immigration, Ms. Kelly, also? I mean, there seems to maybe be less movement right now with the economy not good. Were they maybe counting on more people moving into the state as well?
Madam Chair, I'd have to say that there is an impact from students coming from outside the district, immigration, new students to the country, and I can't answer how much of an impact that had on the forecast today, but could get back to you.
Madam Chair, if I may just add for context, this is on a K-12 area that's about $14 billion for the biennium. So, you know, while it is certainly a noticeable change, there's other factors that are involved here. The level of magnitude that you're seeing here in adjustments in pupil counts projected over, you know, a 12-year continuum isn't, on a percentage terms, not that great.
Madam Chair, there is a slight offset from the decreases in enrollment to the aid payments that are based on local tax capacity. And so because property taxes at the local level did not increase at the rate we anticipated in the November forecast, those equalized levies are going to be increasing in the February forecast compared to the November forecast. And so the enrollment growth is offset by equalized levy payment increases, resulting in just a small change from November.
So, Ms. Kelly, in other words, the local units of government kept their levies lower than anticipated, even though state aids were frozen at current levels. They were able to maintain lower levies? Or was some of that anticipated referendum passage, or was some of it just what they were setting their levies at?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that the Department of Revenue anticipated that local units of government would raise their levies at about 2.5%, and what they saw was an actual 1.9% on average increase in the levy, property tax levies, both for counties, cities, school districts.
So they stayed pretty close to inflationary rates then.
Moving down to aids and credits, this reduction in the next biennium is due primarily to a reduction in property tax refunds, with local levies not increasing at the rate that was anticipated in the November forecast. There's a slight reduction in the amount of payouts in property tax refunds. It's offset by a small increase in the market value homestead credit because market values of homes did not rebound as quickly as we had anticipated in the November forecast. The biggest change here is in Health and Human Services and in the current biennium, and this is primarily a one-time reduction in spending and primarily due to some technical corrections. In the November forecast, we had assumed that the early expansion of medical assistance would occur in January, and this forecast reflects the governor's executive order that expansion would begin to be implemented today. And so there is a couple of months of reduced expenditures because of the change in the implementation date. There was also additional federal financial participation, FFP, on our Medicaid. as a part of stimulus funding, the feds had given us a higher FFP rate than we usually get, and that rate has been tied to unemployment. And we had anticipated in the November forecast that that FFP would be reduced in the last quarter, given that our unemployment was decreasing. An error on the part of the federal government kept our rate at an elevated level, and so we had an additional revenue into the general fund for that reason. There were also some additional technical corrections and transfers in the Health and Human Services area. In fiscal year 12 and 13, while the reduction, I would just add that the expansion or the change in the early expansion date from January to March did have a corresponding effect on the healthcare access fund. And so while there were savings in the general fund, there were additional expenditures relating to that in the healthcare access fund. The 12-13 reductions, while they look relatively minor, there are some changes in enrollment there that are driving, that are kind of masked, reductions in spending masked by other increases in spending. And so we are projecting about a 4% increase in enrollment in medical assistance in the category of adults without children, and in part that's driven by the MA expansion. But that's led by, offset by technical corrections that needed to be made to rates anticipated in the next biennium.
I'm not on Health and Human Services, and I'm just wondering if the MA expansion was to begin today, how many people are actually ready to be rolled over into that program? Has it really been ramped up that fast that they can do that starting today, or is it going to be a slow process, or everyone at once?
Madam Chair, I spoke to Commissioner Jessen yesterday, and they are implementing today and shifting enrollees from Minnesota Care to MA effective today. There is a phased-in approach, or GAMC, effective today. So there is a phased-in approach, but the transition did begin today. Moving on to debt service, there is a very small decrease in expenditure in the current biennium, and that's primarily due to a lower than anticipated interest rate on bonds that we sold in fiscal year 11. In fiscal year 12 and 13, there's a sizable increase in expenditures, and that's primarily due to higher than anticipated interest rates moving forward, and that number is driven by premiums. So the underwriters and the bond buyers like to buy at a higher interest rate, and when interest rates are lower, they advance payment in the form of premiums to the state. When the interest rates are higher, they advance fewer payments because the interest rates are at the level they prefer to buy at. And so we had anticipated advanced premiums when we go out to sell our bonds. We are now seeing forecasting that there'd be higher interest rates, less premium coming into the state on an annual basis, or this is actually a one-time basis in 12 and 13. And so higher than forecasted expenditures in that area. There is a proposal in the governor's budget that we would change how we deposit these premiums so we would see less fluctuation in the forecast as a result of these sorts of interest rate changes. We would use the premium to reduce future bond sales as opposed to depositing it into the debt service fund to make debt service payments.
Ms. Kelly, I'm still a little confused. So when the interest rates are too low, we have to put out a premium, or who puts the premium out in order to get people to buy the bonds?
Madam Chair, the purchaser, the bond buyers, they like to purchase at a higher interest rate that generates greater yield going out. So they advance payment in the form of premiums to the state. So when interest rates are low, we see an early payment from the bond buyers. As interest rates increase, that premium is reduced, and so that's why we're seeing an increased expenditure in the forecast.
Yes, Madam Chair, the state is not in any way harmed or helped by the 5% level that the underwriters like to underwrite these bonds at. It's really a matter of hitting the market at a level that the market is accustomed to, so that 5% is sort of the lowest that those would be traded at. We get the interest costs that would be from the future basically upfronted, so that if you just parked it in an account, you'd be whole over the life of the bonds. By the way we treat this, though, it basically gives us a big one-time upfront payment in our debt service fund, and that is the amount that Ms. Kelly is describing that can be very sensitive to the interest rates.
When was our last big bond sale, and what interest rate was paid for that?
Our last sales were this summer, and I don't have it. It was October, I think, was probably September and October. We had two different sales. One was for new issues. The second one was for refunding. I can get you the exact dates on those, as well as the true interest costs. They were very competitive, in the range of around 3% for the interest rates that those refunding issues were made at. We hit the market extraordinarily well. New Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management and Treasury, Kristen Hansen, can describe that some more, but basically we refunded about everything we possibly could at that point in time, and also at probably the lowest interest rate we were likely to have seen over the last couple of years. The result is we've lowered the interest rate costs for the state and also received some of these one-time upfront premiums that we're discussing here right now. What this forecast suggests is we shouldn't anticipate continued premiums for new GO debt issuances, or at least not certainly at the levels that had been built into the November forecast.
When do you anticipate the next sale of bonds to be?
Would likely be next summer. Typically, they occur in late July, August timeframe, when the debt proceeds fund starts to need cash. We sell debt based upon current authorizations, the timing of the needs for cash in those accounts, and try to do it in usually one, maybe two transactions each year.
Thank you.
Unless there are other questions, I'm going to move to the next slide here, where we have made an effort to depict the percentage change in spending from the 10-11 biennium to the 12-13 biennium. And when you compare dollars to dollars, a $34.3 billion of expenditure in 10 and 11 to a $39 billion of expenditure in 12 and 13, that's a 29% growth in spending. When you try and make a more apples-to-apples comparison in terms of what our assumed expenditures were and our level of service, spending for level of service in fiscal year 10 and 11 compared to 12 and 13, it's just a 9.6% growth. And so to help walk through that, in the fiscal year 10 and 11 biennium, there was federal stimulus funding that was used to offset general fund spending. There was some in the area of K-12 spending, some in the area of health and human services. And so we did make those expenditures, but we used federal dollars instead of general fund dollars. We also saw some savings in K-12 shift, and so we were still making expenditures. We were paying out 70% instead of 90% of current year on the monthly payments that were made.
Senator Bonhoeff, did you have a question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and perhaps you could address the difference between the 1.9 and the 1.4 is, I believe, the property tax recognition shift. So in terms of that, the 1.4 we did as a one-time shift and then assumed we'd pay it right back. And so that's why now we're going to recapture that 1.4. But is the reason why the property tax recognition shift isn't treated in the same fashion, because once you recognize it one time, there's really nothing else you do to it, so therefore it's absorbed?
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, the $1.9 million includes both shifts.
Right.
And so there's a one-time savings when you delay payments into the next year, And so we're actually making those payments in this year, which is the 1.9. It was a one-time savings in the prior biennium. The 1.4 million reflects buying back the shift from the 90% to the 70%.
Senator Bonner.
And Madam Chair, so then my question is with regard to the property tax recognition shift, is it that once you've recognized that early payment, then there's nothing more you can do with that, which is why you can't do it again?
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, if that's correct, okay. Once you've done it.
Done. Okay.
Bigger.
I'm going to turn it back to Commissioner Showalter.
Thank you. So, committee, this is the last slide in the presentation. Obviously, there's a lot of factors. As you try to compare biennium to biennium, it's a very difficult comparison because there's a number of factors. We've gone through a historic period. The recession has permanently reduced our revenue profile. There were significant impacts and risks that we all talked about 2 years ago. And we used appropriately a number of different tools to try and get through that biennium. The fact of the matter is, though, that ultimately there's still a structural gap that is left from that biennium and is still there this biennium and is still out there in 14 and 15. What you see on this slide is a year-to-year comparison of that year's revenues and that year's spending that's built into this forecast. And what you'll see here is in fiscal 12 about a $3.7 billion structural deficit. That in part reflects what Senator Bonhoeff was just referring to, and that is the repayment of the shift. $1.4 billion of costs are built into that year. So once you take that out, you would see that on an annual basis, you have between $2 and $2.4 billion in mismatch between our revenues and our spending. That kind of defines the challenge that the state holds to not only balance this current biennium, but really to make permanent changes so that we don't have this problem recurring over and over again. We know there's risk. We know there's uncertainty. We'll want financial tools to manage that, and we'll always need to adjust the budget. We don't go on autopilot. But we certainly are not on a path right now that is sustainable. Also, although inflation is not part of this forecast on the expenditure side, just for discussion purposes and for your information, we've shown the estimated impact of inflation on a general basis, just an absolute general basis on expenditures so that you can see that we still have significant challenges going out into 2014 and 15 and given the demographic trends and other things that we have, those are some of the higher level questions that we'll ultimately be looking at. So with that, really concludes our presentation of the revenue and expenditure forecast. Happy to take any other questions.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Adding those numbers up there, our forecast here, we got a $5 billion projected deficit right there. I see 5.6. My presumption is the difference is that the 600 and some million dollar carry forward, that's the difference there?
Yep.
Okay.
Madam Chair. Senator, absolutely right.
And then my
very well.
Well, when you're doing budgets, there's so many moving pieces, I'd like to pay attention. Part of the reason our challenge is bigger this year is that in the last budget we had some one-time money from the federal government that we built into baseline and created a bigger challenge for us this time. Going back to that $663 million carry forward, would you put that in kind of the same category as one-time funding? And maybe if we handle that similarly, we might be contributing to a little larger problem in the future biennium? Would that be a fair statement to me?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's a good observation. And in budgeting, you know that factors will change. And so I want to affirm that, yes, your general point is correct. That's one-time money. The balance coming from 10 and 11 into 12 and 13 is definitely one-time money and could be treated, separately as such. Ultimately, I think what's important, and the problem from the past biennium is just the size and the magnitude of some of the one-time fixes and the size and the magnitude of the ongoing challenge. Going into the future, know that $600 million is an important factor, but really what we're trying to look at is, have we gotten the revenue expenditure picture and our projections of those in 14 and 15 in line? Some factors grow faster than one-to-one, so if you make a revenue change or expenditure change, that doesn't always lead to just $1 impact in 14 and 15. It might lead to 2. It might lead to 0.5. And that is part of the mix that ultimately the Finance Committee and all legislators and the governor have to work through in balancing the long-term problem.
Are there any other questions? Well, if not, we thank you for coming in and doing the presentation and for bringing us the better news than we had in November. We certainly appreciate that. And we have no other meeting scheduled for this week, but we'll be seeing you next week. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.